The Inflation Reduction Act was an ambitious bill with worthy goals to reduce deficits, fight inflation, help the IRS, and combat climate change. But 1 year later, there are concerns about its overall fiscal impact, the complexity it adds to the tax system, and the sustainability of its initiatives. Hello, and welcome to The Deduction, a Tax Foundation podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Houlihan, and today we are joined by Will McBride, our Vice President of Federal Tax Policy. Will, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. It's really good to have you here. And so for our listeners, we're going to dive right into this because we're going to be talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. And I want us to be able to get through as much of this as we can because it is a large bill and there's a lot to break down here. So for our listeners, could you just kind of recap and run us through the key parts of the Inflation Reduction Act?
Sure. Actually, I can do this much easier because this bill was pared down quite a lot from the prior reconciliation bill, which was the Build Back Better bill. It came from a lot of ideas, the Inflation Reduction Act, and like I said, winnowed down a bunch of those ideas over time to a fairly short list of tax increases and tax credits. The tax increases are focused on large corporations primarily, and that is, first of all, the book minimum tax. That is a 15% tax on the financial statement income of large U.S. corporations. And the second one is a stock buyback tax of 1% on repurchases of stock by U.S. companies. The third tax increase is a peculiar one. The first two are also peculiar, but this third one is extra peculiar, never been done before. It's an excise tax that applies to pharmaceutical companies such that it encourages them to negotiate with the federal government on a number of drug prices that apply for Medicare. Then there is another revenue raiser, which is different than you usually see. It's a boost to the IRS budget, primarily for enforcement. And greater enforcement is expected to result in greater revenues for the federal government. Now, the credits have gotten a lot of attention. These are 22 tax credits aimed at green energy or clean energy, whatever you want to call it. And the number is certainly exceptional. You don't usually get 22 tax credits in a bill. The dollars attached to those credits is exceptional, and we can talk about it more. The very generous, largely uncapped tax credits aimed at a variety of green energy technologies, both on the investment and production side, and then on the demand side, encouraging consumers to adopt these technologies. So those are the major components. There's some other small stuff we don't need to mention, but those are the major ones that are addressed in the paper that we released.
So, Will, I am no tax policy expert, but I think you just named a lot of different things that are doing a wider range of things. And it seems to me like this bill is trying to handle so many things, so many moving pieces, so many different things. It's just a very ambitious bill. Is that correct?
Absolutely ambitious. That's right. Every component that I've just mentioned, these five components, all have very novel aspects to them. If they're not completely new and never been tried before, many aspects are new and never been tried before. So there is a lot of uncertainty in how these provisions will work. And as the paper discusses in detail, a lot of uncertainty about how these rules will be implemented at the end of the day, and many of them are not fully implemented yet.
And so, Will, one of the things that really strikes me is that based on the name of the bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, it would seem like the goal would be to reduce inflation, but actually, President Biden was quoted as saying, "I wish I hadn't called it that. it has less to do with reducing inflation than it has to do with providing alternatives that generate economic growth. When a bill is not even trying to achieve the very thing it's named after, it does make me wonder if there's a disconnect between a political approach and practical implementation. Do you think you could just maybe walk us through a little bit of the political approach of passing the IRA and how maybe that differs from practical implementation?
Yeah, there's always a disconnect. The question is how big. I would say this is the biggest disconnect I can think of in my lifetime. Again, every one of these components, starting with the book minimum tax, has a large disconnect between the political impetus behind it and the way it was advertised and sold in Congress to get it passed. Of course, it was a reconciliation bill and needed, it was down to the wire to get sufficient votes to get through the Senate. So it was sold under a certain set of criteria, including that it would reduce deficits and thus reduce inflation. But in practice, it's been very different. The reality has been very different. We know more about that reality a year later, and it's particularly on the deficit issue, very clear that the title, as President Biden has acknowledged, title is pretty misleading. It does not reduce deficits. It probably increases deficits a great deal. Even the original revenue score from the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Tax indicated that the bill would increase deficits in the first few years and then make it up in the last few years of the budget window. But that has been updated a couple of times by the Joint Committee on Tax this spring, and as still preliminary. There's still preliminary estimates because it's the green energy credits in particular that continue to grow in cost such that they're now roughly three times the cost originally estimated. So pushing towards $1 trillion over 10 years for the green energy credits alone. So that means that the bill as a whole increases deficits and potentially by quite a lot over the entire budget window. The other thing I would say on the disconnect, the other key piece that is really disconnected between the political salesmanship and the practical reality is the book minimum tax. It was sold as a way to simply ensure a minimum level of tax for large U.S. corporations. And it's simple in that we already have this number ready. It's on their financial statements, on their books that they provide quarterly to shareholders and other investors. So just apply a 15% tax to that number. No big deal, right? Well, it's turned out to be a real nightmare, actually, to implement. And the paper goes into the various issues with that, and I can discuss a little more in detail. But big disconnect there on the book minimum tax.
So as we're discussing the book minimum tax, I just want to take a step back for our listeners real quick and maybe just give a quick refresher. If I have this straight, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Sometimes I'm wrong. I'm no expert here. But book minimum tax, it would be a tax on what companies are reporting to their investors versus what they're reporting on to the IRS. Is that correct? Is that what a book minimum tax is?
Yeah, the idea was to tax financial statement income, okay, which is the income that is published by publicly traded companies on their quarterly financial statements, and to tax it at 15%. Now, and that represents a minimum. So if their regular corporate tax exceeds that amount, then there is no additional tax. It only applies as a minimum. However, there's all sorts of problems with that approach. And these are issues that were raised from the very beginning of this debate, going back to the campaign statements from, for instance, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who backed this idea on the campaign stump back in 2019, 2020. The accountants, and particularly the academic accountants, issued a public letter with something like 300 of these academics who eventually signed onto the letter, identifying real problems with this approach. They identified things like, okay, the that there's a financial statement income is governed by an entirely different set of rules than taxable income, than the income that is subject to tax. And they serve very different purposes. There's a reason why they have different rules. And the purposes are that the financial statements are meant to inform investors, shareholders, and others of the financial health of these companies, right? It's very key information to determine prices in our capital markets, right? And without that information, you get real problems, of course. And so it's very important that be valid information, that it be audited, et cetera. There's a whole system of rules around that to ensure that the information is reliable. Then you've got the tax rules. Tax rules serve an entirely different purpose, which is to raise revenue from these companies in a way that, according to the rules that Congress sets. And Congress, of course, has ideas about how to do this in a way that reaches certain objectives, such as incentivizing investment. That's a big one. Okay. That's a concern that drives a lot of the differences between the tax rules and the book rules. Now, some of the other, to go into that a little more, they are the two systems of accounting treat capital investment very differently. And so this manifested itself in the legislation, in the statute, in the right up to the last few days of the debate in Congress over this bill. The legislative language was getting changed, and in particular, it was a big change that allowed for bonus depreciation to be used for the purposes of this book minimum tax. So instead of the book accounting treatment, basically these types of assets that get this preferential treatment under tax rules, the legislative language allows taxpayers to use the bonus depreciation provision in place of the book rules for basically equipment and short-lived assets. Okay, now that sounds taxpayer favorable and good for investment, and it is. That's what we found in our assessment. However, it's proven to be very difficult to implement. It caused all sorts of problems for taxpayers to mix and match their book accounting treatment of these certain assets with the tax accounting treatment for the special category of equipment.
Let me hop in right there. I think that's an interesting spot for you to really hit on, which is with the book minimum tax, the IRS has this on pause, right? We're waiting for further guidance. So right now, the way the book minimum tax stands is it's not going at all. There is no tax right now until further guidance is issued.
That's right. I mean, that is it. That's the final statement we've gotten from the IRS and the Treasury Department. In June of this year, they said, given all of the issues that are associated with the implementation of this tax, there's so many unresolved issues that they've told taxpayers, you don't need to account for this tax this year. You don't need to report it. You don't need to make any estimated payments on it until further guidance is issued. We don't know when that guidance will be coming. Honestly, from the folks that I talk to, practitioners and others, they don't have any idea either how some of these really tricky issues will be resolved, such as which financial statements to use. There's various standards. There's GAAP. There's international financial reporting standards. There's issues with partnerships that have corporate partners. And those partnerships, in some cases, don't even have audited financial statements. So many issues are outstanding, unresolved, that the IRS finally said, we're not going to implement it. You don't need to worry about it, or don't need to account for it anyway until further notice.
I think right now is actually a great opportunity. We can make a little plug for a different episode of our podcast that really gets into the accounting side of this. It's Accounting for Book Minimum Tax with Professor Scott Dyring. That's a really great episode if you want to really dive in further on just the accounting side. I think that's a really good overview and explanation of it. And as we transition here, maybe a little bit away from the book minimum tax towards green energy credits, it seems to me, based on statements from President Biden, that he's more focused on the green energy credits and investment side of things. And some of the other parts of the bill seem to be maybe falling to the wayside a little bit. I'm wondering if you could just kind of talk to us about the popularity of the green credits and how that's affecting the national budget and the economy at large.
It was a very clear pivot, and very soon after the bill was passed last summer, away from the idea that this was going to be a deficit reducing bill. And instead, the administration clearly wanted to sell it more as a huge investment in addressing climate change. And I think it was sold something like the largest investment in history in addressing climate change, which it probably is. It's, again, as estimates on the green energy credits keep growing and are pushing towards $1 trillion over 10 years. That is certainly unprecedented. So there was this tension always from the beginning between these objectives of what certain members in Congress wanted to do, such as Senator Manchin, insisting on it being a bill that reduces deficits and thus inflation, versus what the administration clearly wanted to do and still wants to do, which is to address climate change through these very generous tax credits. And the administration has won out, basically, because the ball was put in their court after the bill was enacted, right? It then goes to Treasury, the Treasury Department, to implement the rules. And so just about at every turn, the Treasury Department has interpreted the rules and clarified the rules to make those credits more generous. So for instance, they made it clear that the transferability of the credits, which was provided for in the legislation, that is, the credits can be transferred from one taxpayer to another, which is beneficial for taxpayers because, say, a company that's investing in green energy of some type gets the credit, but they have no tax liability. They have no, they're in a loss position. They have nothing, they can't use the credit against their tax liability, but the legislation allows that taxpayer to transfer it or sell it to another taxpayer that can use it. And so this is not totally unprecedented. This has been a few times in history where this has been tried, but certainly not on this scale. The other thing the credits allow is direct pay. Okay, so this for just about anybody. So you can elect to have them paid directly, essentially as a spending program, rather than a credit. And this is the regulations issued by Treasury made clear that this applies to not just corporations, taxable corporations, but this applies to nonprofits, state and local governments. And so this really opens up a new world of possibilities for subsidizing green energy. So for instance, local school boards can, and local government entities can turn their fleet of cars and buses, for instance, into electric vehicles, right? And get subsidized to do that to the tune of $7,500 per vehicle. So that is pretty exceptional. Never been tried again at this scale. So all these things are leading to the escalating costs on the green energy credits, again, growing to somewhere around $1 trillion over 10 years, and it could grow higher. But those are just the recent estimates coming from the Joint Committee, which, again, has not updated their analysis. Their last estimate put it at about $660 billion over 10 years, but they indicated that was preliminary. And hopefully they will provide a more updated estimate that accounts for some of these more recent regulations. Outside groups, including some researchers from Brookings and Penn Wharton and other places, find that these credits will cost closer to $1 trillion over 10 years. So it's really exceptional cost. And that is the intention, apparently, of the administration. They're very proud of the fact that these credits are being taken up and utilized at a really high rate, and that it is, as indicated by the cost, the projected cost. And furthermore, the administration is arguing that this is going to be a great stimulus to not only to these particular sectors, green energy sectors, battery manufacturers, for instance, and car companies that are making electric vehicles, et cetera, but to the economy as a whole, as these technologies are created and proliferate and lead to benefits throughout the economy. So it remains to be seen. We won't know, of course, if that any of those economic benefits come to pass, but it should be noted that, I mean, number one, it'll take years for us to determine if that is the case with these credits. But the history of this kind of approach, which is pejoratively called picking winners and losers, also called industrial policy, does not have a great track record. There's no indication that the government, any government, is particularly good at finding those winners, finding the right technologies to invest in. Instead, all evidence points to the private market being more able to evolve and experiment and engage in competition to find the best technology. So I think we have to assume that this trillion-dollar subsidy will not result in a substantial boost in GDP growth, for instance, over the long run. It does probably boost the economy in the short run in the same way that any stimulus, you spend it, put $1 trillion out there, things happen. And I think things are happening. There's a lot of interest in these credits from Wall Street. Certainly the banks have gotten involved as basically brokers in transferring these credits. And there's certainly a lot of interest in developing technologies that can be eligible for these credits. But again, my guess is that this is going to be essentially a short-term sugar high kind of approach. And eventually the ultimate measure is the productivity that's created from these technologies. And again, not a great track record on this approach.
Will, if I'm following correctly, I just want to make sure I'm pacing with you, is that with these green energy tax credits, sort of the initial hope for this bill was actually to reduce deficits. This is probably going to increase deficits. And on top of that, it seems like there was also an intention with this bill to increase the capacity and growth of the economy. And again, that's also unknown. So we have two real unknowns with this. We see that the deficit probably is going to rise from this, which is against what we were trying to do. And the economy maybe not having the boom it would.
Yeah, I would say that the greater unknown is the economic effects. I mean, because there's still a chance that basically the rosiest scenario is that these credits result in one or more huge steps forward in technological innovation that allows for all sorts of great things to happen for the economy as a whole. Now, that scenario is possible. I would say it's just unlikely. But on the budget side, it's much more certain. There's no reason to think that this legislation as a whole reduces deficits at this point, given the current estimates coming from the Joint Committee on Tax, coming from a number of outside researchers, all point to very high cost of the green energy credits. That alone points to the legislation increasing deficits as a whole. You have the additional factors that the major revenue raisers, the book minimum tax and the stock buyback tax, are both on hold currently. So they're not raising any revenue this year. And it remains to be seen, in particular with the book minimum tax, given how many unresolved issues there are, if that tax will ever raise substantial amounts of revenue, anywhere close to what was initially predicted.
And so, Will, as we are moving towards the latter half of this podcast, this is the last, but certainly not least, I really want to get to the IRS. How has the IRS, with its increased funding, and tackled its responsibilities? And why does it seem to be overwhelmed with some of the complex new programs?
Well, the IRS certainly has had some problems of late. it's pretty well known and been documented that particularly during the pandemic, for instance, the IRS was not answering phones. Basic function, about 90% of the time, the IRS was not answering taxpayer calls to try to get help with complying with tax code. And that's just one of many indications that the IRS is really basically struggling to implement the various new things that came out in the pandemic, the relief payments, et cetera, as well as all the regular complexity of the rest of the tax code. They had a huge backlog of returns that they hadn't gotten to, millions and millions of returns, et cetera. This was provided a rationale then for boosting the IRS budget, which is which was one of the major components of this Inflation Reduction Act. Boosting the IRS budget by a substantial amount, about $80 billion over 10 years. And most of that increased funding was aimed at more enforcement, more audits, particularly for large corporations and high income earners. And a smaller portion was devoted to improving customer service, answering the phones, et cetera, stuff like that. How has the IRS done with the new funding? Well, you've probably seen the news. The IRS itself and the administration and others have noted that the IRS is answering the phones again at a substantially higher rate, something like 34% of the time they are answering the phone in this year's filing season. Now that doesn't sound great for anyone who lives out in the real world. They only answer the phone about a third of the time. I mean, I'd say, actually, that's about how often I answer my phone, perhaps, but I get a lot of spam. But, the IRS should be striving to answer the phone at least at a higher rate than that. But it does appear this additional funding has translated into a higher rate of answering the phones and other measures of customer service. And that's a good thing. And the problem is, though, that as we've discussed, the rest of the Inflation Reduction Act is chock full of new complex provisions, like the 22 tax credits that have all sorts of complicated contingencies, requirements, et cetera, that things like credit, a lot of the credits require a domestic content, which is ill-defined, how you determine what is domestic content versus not domestic content. There's requirements based on geography. So certain disadvantaged places or places that have had oil and gas, fossil fuel focused economies get sort of extra credit with many of these credits. Things like this. I mean, this stuff is very difficult to implement and enforce for the IRS and remains to be seen how they'll do on that front. But what the IRS has mentioned is that in recent testimony in Congress that they're going to need about $4 billion more to implement and enforce these 22 tax credits. So right there, you can see we got a tension. We've got the bill adding a lot of responsibility, very complicated responsibility to the IRS, which is already overwhelmed with a incredibly complicated tax code and a scope of work that goes well beyond just raising revenue, right? It's implementing all sorts of social policy, et cetera, through the tax code. So you got a real tension there. I mean, ultimately, the bill makes life a little harder for the IRS. And even though it boosts the funding, I think it makes the core and ultimate problem here for the IRS worse, which is complexity and an expanded scope. And until that is reversed, until the tax code you start subtracting things from the tax code rather than adding things, the IRS performance, IRS relationship with taxpayers, and our general satisfaction with how the IRS is working are all going to be down, and we're going to be disappointed, I'm afraid. So the solution is simplifying the tax code here, not necessarily boosting the IRS budget without doing that.
As I see it, Will, that was an excellent summary of, I feel like, what's going on with the IRS. I think the thread that clearly pulls through all of these regards, all of these issues, is complexity. And given that complexity, what do you see the challenges faced with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, going forward? And what do you think the future of that is going to be?
Well, we have a little bit of a history on the book minimum tax. We have a particular history in the 80s with something like this. Late 80s, for 2 years, there was a corporate alternative minimum tax that had similar characteristics applied to an adjusted book income tax base. All right. It only lasted 2 years and it was a disaster. Confusion, compliance problems for taxpayers. There's evidence indicates that taxpayers changed their financial statement income, manipulated it to reduce their exposure to the tax. Okay, so that means you're reducing the quality of the information provided to shareholders and reducing the key information that's needed to keep our capital markets functioning. Bad stuff. So, and eventually it was adjusted and tweaked and such that it raised very little revenue. And it continued on for several years after in this form that didn't collect a lot of revenue until it was eventually killed in 2017. So I think that's basically what we're looking at for the book minimum tax here. I think this one is worse in many respects. It has more problems and that it's very much tied to book income. And that, again, the accountants will tell you that there's all sorts of problems with that. And I think as the implementation efforts have shown, it's not clear these issues will be resolved in any satisfactory way that results in any substantial amount of revenue raised for the federal government without dramatically increasing compliance costs for taxpayers and creating confusion and uncertainty for taxpayers and administrators. So I think these issues will continue to become apparent and revealed to members of Congress, probably through a series of hearings over the next period. I don't know how long this period is, but I would say at the end of the period, it goes away, just like the old corporate alternative minimum tax. Both parties recognize the thing is not working as advertised and it goes away. And in particular, it was advertised as a tax that would ensure a minimum level of tax for large corporations, right? Something above zero. Well, there's actually no reason to think that it'll do that. And that was clear from the beginning. That's because it applies to adjusted financial statement income, meaning it's adjusted for various tax concepts, including all the tax credits that are in this bill, the 22 tax credits, and all the other pre-existing tax credits, like the R&D tax credit. As well, it allows things like bonus depreciation. So these are very large tax preferences that mean that a lot of large companies will continue to pay zero tax in any given year, very much legally, following the rules of this book minimum tax. So I think when that becomes apparent and revealed after the fact to members of Congress, I think they'll have to say, well, it doesn't work. Let's get rid of it. So I think that one will die eventually, whether it takes a year or it may take longer. Could take 5 or 10 years, who knows? But the green energy credits, I think, certainly have an appeal. They're, quote, working beyond expectations, and that the cost continues to grow higher. But I think in this environment of the fiscal challenges that we're facing, deficits continuing to grow, the forecasts of the national debt going way above the size of the economy, that these pressures will just continue to grow to do something about our unsustainable debt trajectory. And I think in that context, you have to think members of Congress will really start to look around for ways to address it, and including addressing the cost of these green energy credits. So I expect eventually those will also be pared back, whether that's through some sort of selective repeal or capping of some of those credits. I think that'd be the wise move anyway. And I think that may take again some time for members of Congress to recognize that and act on it.
So, Will, as we wrap up here, could you just break down the walkaway big picture for our listeners for the Inflation Reduction Act 1 year later?
Sure. Big picture is that you need to be concerned about practical realities of these proposals. That is, our lawmakers and our policymakers need to think about, okay, does this just sound good as a bumper sticker? Or is this actually going to work? There needs to be a greater focus on doing things that work. There's intentions, and many of the intentions behind this bill were admirable. Reducing deficits. Yes. Wide agreement, we need to reduce deficits. But we can see in practice, this bill is not doing that. It's making deficits worse. Wide agreement that corporate taxation is way too complicated, needs to be simplified such that we understand who's paying what. There's some degree of fairness across companies. Wide agreement. But does this book minimum tax do that? No indication that it does that. No indication that it's guaranteeing any minimum level of tax above zero for any company. Instead, it's just adding more complexity and a kind of arbitrary tax on certain companies given certain characteristics. So I think it's really that is the lesson I see, that policymakers should really pay attention, and the rest of us should hold these policymakers to account to make sure they are proposing something that can work, that can actually achieve the objectives that are being laid out.
In the end, good intentions maybe do not always make good tax policy. Will, thank you so much for guiding us through the complex bill, boiling it down for us to understand. Please check out Will's paper on the Inflation Reduction Act 1 year later. Will, is there anything else you'd like to plug while you're here on the show? Anything you're working on right now?
We've been talking about the debt and deficits issue. We have a blog series that we put together earlier this year and an event that we did with Brian Riedel in July, a webinar in which we discussed these issues, and we're continuing to do work in this space, and we'll be putting together a paper for publication in the next few weeks, summarizing where we're at and the big issues in this debate over how to address our national debt and the growing deficits we're seeing in the current forecast.
Listeners, please check out Will's amazing work on all of these very complex issues. Will, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Deduction. To learn more about the Tax Foundation and The Deduction, visit us at taxfoundation.org/podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Tax Foundation. If you've been enjoying our show and want to help us grow, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show. And if you didn't enjoy The Deduction, well, keep it to yourself. Another way you can support our work is by donating to the Tax Foundation on our website. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.